This episode of the Outside Podcast is brought to you by the all-new 2024 Lexus GX. You ever pick up a piece of gear that inspired you to up your game? My first full suspension mountain bike was like this. So plush and fun, it changed riding a bike from something I thought I'd never forget how to do to something I realized I wanted to do better. The all-new Lexus GX is an exceptionally capable rig that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. With available dynamic sky panorama glass roof, front row massaging seats, and multi-terrain select, the all-new GX is rugged on the outside, refined on the inside. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer or go to lexus.com/GX to learn more. This is the Outside Podcast.
So one example was recently, not that long ago, I was invited to participate in breathing exercises, like a yoga breathing type of exercise. But this was a new environment that I stepped in. I didn't know these people in this environment, and the space looked safe to me. Everything was fine. They brought me a mat, I put the mat down. And they said, Chad, have you ever done breathing work? And I said, yeah. You know, and said, okay, well, you know, I just want to walk you through the process. And this is what you need to do. So I put my service dog axe right next to me. And the mat, I got on the mat. And I started doing this breathing exercise along with everybody else. As I'm in this space, the folks, they were... like they were just basically kind of like not really chanting, but being very expressive with their breathing. You know, you can hear everybody really breathing, and it wasn't like chants, but it was some of them, you know, someone came out with like noise and almost kind of like snoring, loud snores and stuff like that, you know. And so, you know, all this is going on. And as I'm doing it, I'm kind of like going into this interesting, weird trance. And when I start to go in this trance, I start to unravel. I was angry and I just started like bawling, crying. And literally I was having an episode right there in the yoga place. I got my stuff and I was stumbling down. I had Axe with me and Axe was helping me trying to get it, navigate out of me. And all I can think of at that given time was my mind was going back to war and babies crying, hell going on, and it was all coming at me. When I got out of the room, you know, I found my place outside on this green grass, and I'm trying to, you know, calm myself down and I'm trying to cool myself down. But man, I sat there for almost like 45 minutes just bawling and screaming and crying and angry. And Axe is like, oh, like he's just like shaking and trying to, you know, calm me down and everything. And that person who invited me came out. They basically checked in with me and it's like, are you okay? And I was not okay. I was in the headspace of needing to protect myself by any means necessary.
Chad Brown is not someone to be taken lightly. He is a veteran of the U.S. Navy. He went to a very serious grad school for art and design. And now he's trying to save the world. In fact, he won't rest until he has. More on that later. He's also no stranger to Outside. Over the years, we've written about him a lot. A big feature article, an online story about one of his nonprofits, Love is King, which takes people of color on wilderness expeditions, a video profile of him, and a video profile of his service dog, Axe. And we're not the only ones. He's an outdoor media darling. The other day, he texted me a link to a story that his local camera store, Pro Photo Supply, had done on his work as a photographer and videographer. Chad's story is great. It's worthy of all this attention. And at times, it's difficult. He still suffers from PTSD from his service overseas. But he uses that difficulty to connect veterans with kids on fishing trips for his other nonprofit, Soul River Inc. He's on a mission to bring the outdoors to more people, especially people of color. He does that by organizing expeditions and making films. He's a storyteller. So today, we thought we'd do something a little different and let him tell his story, for the most part, in his own words. Here's Chad.
There's a mindset that a lot of people think that Black people don't like the outdoors, or Black folks are not in the outdoors. And there's also a mindset amongst Black folks that say things like, that's not what Black folks do. We don't hike. We don't, that kind of stuff. But the thing is that as a kid growing up, my exposure to outdoors was me seeing nothing but Black folks. It was my family. So my narrative also says at one point is like, where's the white folks at? I don't see no white folks in the outdoors and everything. And so it's kind of interesting because my narrative is what I see is people of color in the outdoors, camping, riding horses and wrestling cattle, and building fire, survival. That was my upbringing. Sometimes I would go on a hunt for deer hunting with my dad. And there was actually one day that my dad came across a mother deer, and that deer was dead, and the baby fawn was next to the deer. And my dad picked up the baby fawn and brought the fawn home, and that fawn became my pet. I was like the only kid in the city, in the hood, that would walk around the block with a dog leash to my deer, and it was so cool. I mean, I thought it was cool and I loved it. It was an awesome memory of my childhood. My mother and my father, they welcomed me to live my childhood like that. So me and my deer, we were inseparable. He would sleep with me at night, and I would take him to school with me sometimes. I would, got memories that I would walk my deer to the back seat of the car, and that's how we roll. My mom would take me to the grocery store. We'll go to the grocery store together, and no joke, I would walk into the grocery store with my deer on a leash right behind my mom as she's pushing the basket getting groceries.
How old were you?
I was around 8, 9 years old, but yeah. And the name of my deer, that his name was Bambi,
because you were 8 years old.
Yeah, exactly.
Where does the narrative that Black people aren't going outside, where does that come from?
It's kind of hard to say where that comes from. I think it really comes from the lack of information that we are not receiving, and how media plays a role with that as well. When you look at magazines, it has always been the images of white folks. It's always been those images. If you got enough of those images showing, from GQ magazine, to Men's Health and all that. And
you can say outside, it's fine.
Okay, Outside magazine, The media is like educating both audiences in a really interesting way. If you open your eyes more and look a little deeper, you'll see that me being Black, I don't see myself. And then from a white perspective I see myself. This is cool. I can do this. It can go either way,
Are you saying that the, because Chad talks about this too, the narrative that, that black people aren't welcome in the outdoors, are you saying it comes down to like a fear of encountering like forms of aggression that white people just don't experience as often?
I absolutely. I think it is, you know, raised in those, during those times of Jim Crow, where Jim Crow was, you know, with Jim Crow are laws that, you know, terrorized black individuals. I think you probably have heard of the Green Book, which is this book that would let people of color know where they could go, where black people could go, where it'd be safe for you to go. That energy has moved forward into generations of, you know, the outdoors is just not for you. Like, it's like, you be careful where you go, you, because it's not safe. So there's this negative connotation that comes with being in the outdoors as a person of color that is dangerous, but there's not anything to balance it on the other side. Like, this is this wonderful experience I had. This is this joy I had. I loved being in nature. So as a practitioner of trauma healing, we have to dispel and rewrite the narratives of the past. My name is Lisa Collins. I'm an assistant professor at Lewis and Clark College and a small business owner. I'm a board member of the Alaska Wilderness League and a very good friend of Chad Brown.
I mean, let's jump back to your story. I mean, kind of walk me through, you know, after leaving home, what path are you on?
Yeah. So, as I got older, I was definitely into art. My mom, she supported me the best way possible, fostered all of my creativity. School was fine up to a point. You know, my mom got married and I didn't really have enough money to finish art school. And so I dropped out of school and ended up joining the Navy. I was over in Africa and Somalia doing small convoy runs. Well, not really small convoy runs, but convoy runs through the city of Mogadishu. I was not sure what I was doing, honestly, but I did it. War is a horror show. It's ugly. And you know what? It's not just about, you know, the firefighting, you know, because that happens by default. But what you see that's ugly is what man can become behind enemy lines. And that's scary. That's scary. There's a saying that we have always said on these deployments when we're doing these things in, as in the Navy, is, you know, you never know someone until you actually go on a deployment. And that's when you really get to know who that person is, how they respond under stress, or under fire. It brings the worst out of us. Some people are able to adapt and still be able to maintain themselves as a human being. And some people are not able to do that. And they change to something else. And you either become the witness to that or you become part of the process. There was one point where a vehicle was stopped and vehicle was stopped and me and a couple guys, we were observing because we were working with the Marines, and the Marines, they were there. And so they're actually the ones that stopped the vehicle and they were checking the vehicle, et cetera. and the back of the vehicle had a bunch of grain. There was an old man, Somalian. He had a cane. He looked like he was maybe in his 70s, I guess. But he had a cane and his walk with a cane. And he approached the back of the vehicle. He took his hand out of his pocket. He grabbed a handful of grain and he put it in his pocket. One of the Marines saw that and treated him as he was being a thief. And all the Marines that came around took the butt of their gun and beat him to death in the street. We could not engage of stepping in and like take, you know, like to change that. We all witnessed that. So, yeah, we stood there, front row center, and watching this. And that old man couldn't defend himself. That was an old man that was crippled. And hell, you're in a third world country, and you could tell that the man was starving to death. And he took a handful of grain, put in his pocket, and he gets beat down to death. You know, and it sucks, you know. And so, like I said, it's like one thing you witness, you know, firefighting. That's scary as hell to be in a firefight. That is scary as hell. What I would have to say that the worst, scariest thing is seeing how war can change a man. Yeah. Coming back into civilian life was definitely a struggle for me. I have not yet even found a language to even communicate what I've went through. And so coming back is this person that's full of rage, anger, lost, didn't really know where to go. It was hard for me to stay in conversations with people. There were times that I didn't want to be around people. I did forge my way through college, went down to Atlanta, and I finished off my schooling. I guess, you know, I was, trying to get into grad school. I didn't feel confident, but I really wanted to be there, and I wanted, you know, to go to that school. And so I had decided to, in a way, self-sabotage. And so what I did was I toured the back of a McDonald's bag, the brown paper bag, and I wrote a letter to the dean over at Pratt. And I for sure felt that this was a way to sabotage. And of course, I submitted that with my portfolio, but I got back in the mail an acceptance letter from Pratt, and it was a personal letter that was also written on a torn piece of brown paperback. And so I ended up taking that path. I got the hell out of Atlanta. I still had this mindset of, you know, this military in me and everything. And so, no joke, I put everything in my backpack that I need. And I left my apartment in Atlanta with the door open to everything in there. And I just walked out of that apartment with my backpack to New York. Got to New York, got myself settled into the dorms over at Pratt in Brooklyn, started taking my classes. I was in the city as a creative student at that time, and learning a lot, being engaged and connecting with so many creatives from all over the world at this freaking school. And it was amazing. And then slowly I started picking up the camera and started shooting in the city, doing many different type of engagements, fashion in the city, then Soho. It was amazing. Up until a point one day, I had a meeting at the Towers and I was running late, and just so happened my train stalled. And as I'm sitting there, I'm watching the plane come in and basically flies right into the Towers. And the train was silent. Everybody was silent. And then all of a sudden, it turned into a horror show. People were screaming. Everybody was screaming. It was crazy. And I'm sitting here, I'm calm. It was so weird. It was like, I've been here before. And so instead of me going home, again, I'm back on mission. And my mission now is to get to my job, because I can't get to my meeting. Now I'm going to go get to my job. That's my mission. So I'm making my way on mission, walking through the streets all the way up to 40, a little bit past 42nd Street, and passing just so many people. And I walk in, finally get to the job. I walk in, and people's freaking out. I'm engaging with folks, but I'm not freaking out. And it's kind of weird. I sit down at the desk, right in the computer. I'm still on mission.
Was your reaction in that moment at all concerning to you at that point? Like, oh, I'm not reacting the way everybody else is reacting to this unprecedented kind of thing.
When I look back, the answer to that question now, I think I was reacting as a broken soul. I think when you're broken and you've been through a lot of stuff and you haven't found any kind of closure or no healing, you become numb to what's in front of you really quick. And
you want to take a break?
We're good.
Yeah?
Yeah, we're good.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I appreciate your sharing these stories. I can tell how difficult it is to talk about. I hate to have to ask you to do it. Especially a couple times.
It's all good. I just kind of, it's a process. You know, I live with this, PTSD shit, you know, and I have been able to find many different ways to manage and to help support myself. And me and my girlfriend just like merge our lives together. And
you mean like recently?
Yeah. Yeah, we've been together like a year and a half now. We merge our lives, and you know, and she's a witness to my PTSD, and it's hard. It really is hard. Yesterday she was like, which I take my hat off to her, but as she was working, she was like listening to a podcast book on how to love your partner who struggles with PTSD. And she listened to the whole book. It kind of landed on me. It gave me a lens to look at myself and say, damn, Chad, you thought you had it managed. You've been into this therapy game and you've been able to find ways to cope with your PTSD stuff. But you're really fucked up. And so me talking about it and sharing, it's a little bit hard, but it's also a form of therapy too. You know, it helps, you know.
Does it help though? Because I mean, and there's I think different levels, superficial levels and deeper levels here, but like on one level, both yesterday and today, I come here, you're in a good mood.
Yeah.
You're like a funny guy. You're telling stories. And then, you know, at a certain point in the interview, different points in the interview, you go back there. I kind of implicitly ask you to go back there, relive whatever you feel comfortable with. And your mood changes, your demeanor changes. It changed yesterday. Mm-hmm. It changed today just now. And that's to be expected. That is what it is. But like, you know, this is also your job. You're doing this professionally. You tell the story professionally.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And like is that something that you can keep doing? Is that something that you like, is this process and job and message that you're trying to share, because it's so deep down tied to the traumatic stuff that you went through, can you ever really get free of it? We'll be right back.
Brought to you by Lexus. There are things you can own that do much more than their stated functions. Things like a professional-grade kitchen range or an aerodynamic carbon fiber bike. The truth is, exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. They push you to reach higher, to go farther. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. You don't buy it just for the life you have, but also for the life you want to have. Its exceptional capability will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed, making plans that were once outside your scope. But as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.
It took a while for me to get to a point of finding healing, because through this whole little process I was going through in my life, I was being challenged with certain things mentally that I didn't quite understand what was going on, but it was disrupting my thoughts. I was having blackouts, anger moments. I took a break. I was very fortunate and blessed, and I took a break and backpacked over in Japan, and I didn't quite understand what was going on with me until I came back to New York. And from New York, I got this job opportunity. You know, this job was a hire for a senior art director at an agency. Right when I started doing the work at the agency, up until where my contract ended, boom, that was when things really unraveled with me. I was really losing my damn mind. I did not know what was going on. There were times that I'll have blackouts in my own vehicle. I would lose track of time. When the PTSD hit me, I lost everything. I lost everything. It robbed me from everything. I fell into basically a really, really dark, dark place. And I became homeless. And I needed money. I was borderline even to with thoughts of committing
a crime to steal so I can get something to eat. I would, you know, go to the blood banks, and it was kind of weird standing in line. I never thought I'd be part of that kind of population. Here I am, all my education, fought my country, done all kinds of shit, traveled the freaking world, and I'm standing right in line in this particular kind of population of drug addicts, crackheads, prostitutes, and I'm standing there, and when I get through the line, submit everything, I get into it, they walk me to the back, I got it, sit in one of those chairs, they'll put the needle in me, got a TV up there, and they give me a little pump, a hand pump, and I kind of keep pumping, and I have to fill a little container of blood, a plasma blood, up. It got into the system to where when you first come, you get $60. Second time you come, you get $40. And, you know, and then there'll be a couple times you get like $25 to $30. And I would stretch that all the way to the next. And I can only come in on a Tuesday, but I can't come in on a Wednesday, but I can come in on a Thursday. And that was how I survived. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I believe it's a good 7 years of my life.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I was in that dark space for a long time.
How I got connected with Chad was I was invited to a demonstration that he was doing out by the river. I mean, I love the outdoors. I fish. Before I met Chad, I was, you know, learning how to fly fish, and I'm an angler, and I just loved outdoors. And when I went out to the demonstration, we were on the river in Oregon, and we put on our, you know, fly fishing gear, like our waders and boots. We went on the water and practiced our cast. And Chad talked about his journey, his healing journey of being out in, you know, in the backcountry, and his struggles with post-traumatic stress disorder, and how, you know, being in nature was helping him to heal.
Fly fishing was presented to me as a way of healing and processing. Like, when people look at my image and all this kind of stuff, they think I'm like this hardcore angler. But fly fishing wasn't presented to me like that. It was presented to me as a way of life, as a way of processing, and the art of giving back. I spent time on the water and found my healing through that process, through fly fishing. But I didn't fish that much. It was about this, like, this attaining this kind of knowledge that you can learn if you stay quiet long enough to listen to the river and how that speaks to you, how that lands with you. And then when we talk about the fish and talking about connecting to the fish, it was talking about love. If you are able to connect with the steelhead, and if you're able to bring that steelhead in, that just means that you just align with the perfect alignment of the right language that connected to that fish. You cracked the code specifically for that fish to connect with you. And when you bring that fish in, this is an opportunity for you. It's like really symbolic. This is an opportunity for you to get on your knee. You keep the fish wet, allow the fish to breathe around your hands, you feel the gills, and you take the time to look at the scales. The scales will tell you the journey of the fish. And when you can understand and see that journey of the fish by the scars of what that fish has been through, it would give you a deeper respect to the fish and to its journey. And when you're done understanding what you have and look at the colors and admire the beauty, then you turn around and you release that fish back on its journey. Learning to let go of something that you love, in an interesting way, there's healing in that process. Now, I'm still healing in my process, but down to the simplest form of like catch and releasing that, it actually made me feel good. It made me feel really good. They feel good and I feel good.
His organization, Love is King, that's what Love is King does, is it takes people out into the backcountry, out into Alaska, out into places where people of color probably have never been before. And he was asking people, like, you know, do you think you can do this? And, you know, from putting on the gear to putting up the tent to turning on the jet boil to this is the kind of food we'd eat. And these are the kind of things that I bring. And would you be interested in learning more about conservation and Alaska? And would you be interested in learning how to be in the backcountry and enjoy it? And my soul said yes. I think it's the connection for him is who he is, like authentically, is to bring healing, connection, and good things to the world. He, you know, he's not a millionaire because of it. He works really, really, really hard. And he is constantly pulling back and pulling people forward who want to also bring good to the world.
People may think I'm a workaholic, but it's probably why I got a lot of things going on and, you know, and doing this and creative and film and nonprofit work and conservation and all that. It's really not a lot to me. I'm managing that, but what a lot of people don't see that this is my way of healing.
It does seem like he is working so, so hard and almost like working himself to the bone. Do you see this, his effort and work and his willingness to sort of sacrifice as sustainable, as something that he can?
Like, no.
Okay.
I mean, I talked to him a lot. You know, we're really good friends, and I talked to him a lot about like, hey, you know, what's right size here? Like, how do we, you know, take care of yourself? And I understand us also as a trauma practitioner, like sometimes when we're on the wheel, on the hamster wheel, that is a way of regulation, like all the things. And we do need to stop and take a breath. And I think that is a form of regulation, is to keep everything going, to keep all the plates. And he has a lot of plates. And it's something that we do talk about quite often, is how do you take a breath and not have so many plates?
So here's kind of the crux of things as I see them, just as I'm thinking through the story. And I'm curious just like how do you manage the situation if your work is your medicine or part of it, and you have this kind of ongoing need for healing because you will get re-triggered or you will be, you just, that's part of you now. That is part of who you are. And your goal is to change the world, save the world ecologically, and heal large groups of people. you know, you set these incredible goals. How do you find rest and recovery, and how do you manage being always on in this way that it sounds like you're kind of describing?
I think rest is it's been defined more as being able to break away and take a vacation and being able to sit and probably do nothing, et cetera. You know, I think that's a traditional way of looking at rest. Looking at it in an unconventional way, I believe rest can be found even while you are working. I may find my rest in the morning. I may find my rest in the afternoon. But however I'm managing my time, I'm recharging constantly, you know, all the way through the whole process. You know, every day I'm recharging. Throughout the day, I'm recharging. It just looks different every day. But it's very important for me to recharge.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I asked him this question and his answer was sort of like, I take my rest by working more.
That sounds about because right.
Because I find it so healing.
Yeah.
Like, how do you extricate yourself from this pain if it is also kind of like the source of the narrative that moves your healing?
Yeah. The pain that I've experienced, that Chad's experienced, is only a cornerstone to the healing. Healing is not, it's not, you don't have to be dancing every day with your pain to experience the joy and the bliss of healing. And as a healer and as a person who has done work myself, there is a place where you get to that is peaceful and joyful, and it doesn't involve the pain of the story. You know, the story is there, but I'm observing it from where I'm at today. I'm not dancing with it. It's not intertwined in who I am. I speak of it as an observer to others to help them see and wonder if you want some joy and bliss in your life. And I see Chad pulling away from that old paradigm into a new one.
I have not, and I don't think you can ever overcome PTSD, but I do know that you can better your tools in your toolbox to help you be able to remain and stay function that will help you manage your PTSD. I'm still that veteran fighting those demons. I'm still that veteran that been stamped with 50% mentally disabled. I'm still that veteran that has issues when I go in certain places or when I'm hearing sounds. So there's a lot of years that I'm sharing here. And within those years, there's a lot of therapists that I have connected with along the way that has helped me be able to understand not just who I am today, but understand, you know, what I need to put in place to help me for wellness. You know, and so, yeah, you know, it's, you know, like I say, rest can be found in many different ways.
Chad Brown is the founder of Love is King and Soul River, Inc. Special thanks to Travis Avery and Kevin Gatta for speaking with me at length. This episode was produced by me, Peter Frickwright, with editing, music, and sound design by Robbie Carver. The Outside Podcast is made possible by our Outside Plus members. Learn more about all the benefits of membership at outsideonline.com/podplus.